We'll be looking this morning at John chapter 9 and verses 8 through 23. 8 through 23 of John chapter 9. As we begin this morning, we want to think together about being fake, or rather faking something in order to get personal gain. We've all done that, right? You say, I never would do that. Faking something to get personal gain. You know, even little kids know how to do that. I mean, little kids learn from a very early age how to fake something for personal gain, right? They don't like the food they're eating, and so all of a sudden their tummy hurts. Or perhaps even as they just get a bit older, maybe into high school, or they have a test coming up. They didn't study for it, though you don't know they didn't study for it, but all of a sudden, oh, they're sick. I mean, they feel like they're going to throw up, and they just need to stay home from school that day. But they, you know, no one has to train kids how to fake things in order to get out of something. But then as we get into adulthood, we still do that. We just, or maybe a little bit more sophisticated at it. And so you see and you hear stories about people faking an injury so they can get workers' compensation or disability. Or sometimes a business owner is struggling, and so they decide, well, if I burn my business down, then I could get a lot of insurance money. And so all of a sudden a business burns to the ground, and hopefully that business owner's thinking that they can fake that arson so they can collect the money. Or then you also have faith healers, the Benny Hinns of the world, who go out and perform miracles. Exorcisms and healings of back problems and cancer and cataracts and those who are wheelchair bound and blindness and all kinds of unverifiable miracles. And that's just it, right? Because every time one of these things happen, whether it's a child whose tummy hurts, they can't finish their meal, or they don't want to go to school because they just don't feel well, or whether there's an injury and there's a disability or a workers' compensation claim, what do we always do? What does the insurance company do if they find arson? Well, they investigate. They investigate. That's what we do. We perhaps monitor our child's behavior as soon as the clock turns to about 3 o'clock and we know that school would be over. And are they all of a sudden running outside, jumping on the trampoline? They're all better now that school's over. Sometimes you find injury claims that the insurance company might even hire a private detective or send an insurance adjuster out to look at the arson and bring in experts to investigate and make sure that this wasn't a fake. And then also with faith healers have been caught with microphones in their ear, with someone in the balcony watching so that they can fake their miracles. And they've been caught in alleyways with throwing piles and piles of unopened envelopes with prayer letters into dumpsters. And so investigative journalists have gone in and actually tried to determine whether this is a fake. And that's exactly what we're going to see this morning in John chapter 9. An investigation into what many believe is a fake. Now, last time we had this maybe silly story, or as the sermon title is this morning, it's a likely story of a man who was blind from birth, and all of a sudden another man came along and made mud cakes and rubbed that mud on this man's eyes, and now he can see. Well, that's what we saw last time, and we ended right there. He came back seeing. And this week, as we approach verse 8 of chapter 9 and go all the way into verse 23, we're going to hear this unblind man tell his story. And the hearers of the story are going to cry, fake. And so they're going to do what we talked about earlier. They're going to call for an investigation. Only this man's story was different. This man's story had history to it. It had witnesses. It had parents. But none of that's going to matter. It won't stop the denial. What we'll see this morning is perhaps the most concerted, organized investigative review to determine if a miracle was fake. And we're going to ask two questions about this text this morning. We want you to ask two questions of this text as we go through it. The first question is this: what do you learn about Christ in the Word this morning? What do you learn about Christ? And the second question is this: what do we learn about ourselves? What do we learn about Christ, and what do we learn about ourselves? As you walk through the text this morning, there's sort of a natural flow from verses 8 into verse 23, and there's kind of three sections to this part of the story. The first section is this: the dumbfounding undeniability of the divine. The dumbfounding undeniability of the divine. So that's what we're going to see at first. Everyone's shocked, dumbfounded at what is undeniably divine. Jesus is divine. The second thing we're going to see as we go through this text is the determined denial of the depraved. So even though something is undeniably divine, the depraved are determined to deny it. And then the third item that we'll light upon as we end our passage this morning is this: the chokehold of cowardice. The chokehold of cowardice. So the dumbfounding undeniability of the divine, the determined denial of the depraved, and the chokehold of cowardice. And this is the question that you should be asking yourself this morning, that I'm asking myself. Am I a denier of God because I fear man? Am I a denier of God because I fear man? Or am I a bold confessor of the undeniable Christ? Am I a bold confessor of the undeniable Christ? The title of the sermon this morning is A Likely Story: The Unblind Man and the Undeniable Miracle. Would you look with me, please, at verse 8 of John chapter 9. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is not this the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So you can see right here off the bat, verse 7 was simply that he came back from Siloam seeing. And that's where we ended last time. And now he's come back. We don't know exactly how much time has transpired between him going to Siloam and coming back. There could be a day or two in between this. But this is a dumbfounding miracle. It's a mind-blowing moment for these people. Clearly, everyone's taking notice of this man. They can't get around it, whatever it is. And so the first reaction of the people is this: is what I'm seeing real? Is what I'm seeing real? And so they're trying to determine his identity. But the point is this: they recognized him. Even if they thought it was a different man that looked like that guy, the point is everyone recognized him. There was recognition there. That was the same thing as Peter and John. You remember when they went to the temple to pray and they healed a lame man on the way? And in Acts 3, 9, and 10, we read this: and all the people saw him walking and praising God and recognized him as the one who sat at the beautiful gate of the temple asking for alms. And they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. And so the first verification of this man's identity, the first verification of this miracle in this investigative review, is that he was recognized. But why does an argument ensue here in verses 8 and 9? Why wasn't it just clear? Yeah, this was the beggar. That was him. Why are there some people that are denying it? No, that wasn't him. It's somebody that looks like him. Why does a controversy happen at all? Well, because in their minds, nobody gets healed from blindness. It doesn't happen. It's impossible. And that is what we call a presupposition. A presupposition. It's a fancy word that just means an assumption. It's an assumption that we make. And when we're talking amongst a group of people, we do it all the time. We make assumptions about things. It's something we take for granted. I'll give you an example. If you were having dinner at the table, And your fork was sitting there on your plate because you had already taken some bites of food, and the next thing you know, your fork slowly lifts off your plate up into the air and hovers just about a foot above your plate. Just stays there, hovering in the air, just making little movements. What would you assume? Well, immediately you would assume all kinds of things. Probably the first thing you'd assume is someone's playing a joke. Somebody's playing a joke here. Somebody's doing this. I don't know how they're doing it. So what might you do? Well, first you might swipe your hand over the top of the fork, because you assume maybe it's attached to a string on the ceiling that's so light and thin that I can't see. Or the next thing you might do to investigate is you reach your hand under the table and you try to see, is there a magnet under here that's maybe pushing this fork up? But here's what you don't immediately assume. You don't immediately assume that there's no such thing as gravity, or that the laws of gravity have immediately been suspended, and thus your fork is suspended above your plate. You also wouldn't immediately assume, oh, there's no such thing as gravity. No, your presupposition, your assumption is gravity exists and it's still in play, even for my fork. Therefore, there must be some other explanation because I have that presupposition. And it's the same with these people. Their presupposition is that no human can heal another human of blindness. That can't happen. That's what they assume. And so therefore, they have to look for another alternative to that assumption. And so what is their first explanation? Their first explanation is there's a string holding up the fork. Or, as they say it, this is a different guy. This is not the same blind man that sat there begging. It's a different guy. Well, that brings us to our second verification. Our first verification is he was recognized, but our second is he could serve as his own witness. There at the end of verse 9, you see him saying, I am the man. Notice in verses 8 and 9, they're talking about him. But what we don't see is that anybody asked him directly, hey, are you that same man? No, they're talking to each other. And it's like you read the end of verse 9 there, and it's as if he's saying, guys, I'm blind, I'm not deaf. Okay, I can hear you. It's me. But he can't even convince them. Now, likely there were many ways that he could convince them. I mean, he sat there. Again, he wasn't deaf, or at least the Bible doesn't say he was. So he probably heard a lot of conversations. He probably heard conversations amongst other beggars. He probably heard conversations amongst Pharisees walking into the temple. He heard what was going on at events. He knew about Jesus of Nazareth. And so if they really wanted to know if he was telling the truth, they could have just said, okay, prove it. Tell us what this guy's name is. Tell us what this beggar's name is over here. How long has this beggar been sitting here? What just happened, you know, last week at the temple? If you're really that guy sitting by the temple, then prove it. But their presupposition that a human can't heal another human of blindness was so strong that they just immediately assumed this can't be the man. But at the same time, they must have had an inkling. They didn't want to believe it, but they needed some kind of explanation. So they ask him another question, verse 10. So they said to him, then how were your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. You see their presupposition here? Well, if you're the man and not some other guy, then how are you seeing? It's a rhetorical question. In other words, you can't be the man if you're seeing. See what's happening? They're admitting that this is an impossible situation. And that is going to lead them, it's going to lead us, to one and only one logical conclusion. This can only be of God. This can only be of God. This miracle proves Christ's deity. It is so dumbfounding, it is so mind-blowing, it is so impossible for a human being to do that it can only be of God. And that is the dumbfounding undeniability of the divine. The dumbfounding undeniability of the divine. It's so incredible. Jesus must be divine. But to these Jews, it's A likely story. And so they ask, well, where is he? Show the man. Show this invisible man that rubbed mud on your eyes and told you to go to Siloam and wash. Prove to us that there was anyone at all. And so their presupposition forces them to conclude that this man must be lying. But the man says, well, I don't know where Jesus is. Well, how could he not? Wouldn't he have followed him? No. Remember? When Jesus sent him to Siloam, he was still blind. And when he came back, Jesus is gone. He didn't know where he was. In fact, he had never even seen Jesus. But as much as these people want to deny it, as much as these people just don't want to go there, that the laws of gravity have been suspended, they can't. How do we know they believed it? How do we know that these people believed that a miracle had transpired? Because they had to take it further. Verse 13. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. Now, why would these people, other than the fact that they do believe that it happened, take this man to the Pharisees? Why would they even think to take him to the Pharisees? Well, if you'll remember, the murder plot to kill Jesus in John chapter 7 was a secret. Only the Jewish leadership knew about it. But with what just happened at the end of John chapter 8, where Jesus declared that he was the I Am, the covenant God of Israel, that secret murder plot turned into a very public attempt of a political assassination as they picked up stones to stone him. Now, Jesus had escaped at the end of chapter 8 out of the temple. And whether or not, as he was walking out of the temple, he passed by this blind man, or whether several days or several weeks had gone by, we don't know. But why would the Jews bring this unblind man to the Pharisees? Because they knew the Pharisees were angry at Jesus. And this man was claiming that it was Jesus of Nazareth who had healed him. There was even a rule made about Jesus. The Pharisees had issued an edict, a rule to the people about Jesus. We're going to see that a little bit later in our chapter. But just trust me for now, these people knew that they should take this man to the Pharisees based on what he claimed. But you say, even if there was a rule about Jesus, even if there was a very public assassination attempt, why would they want to do that to Jesus? Why would they want to turn this man in? Well, what we see here is a very interesting piece of character that lies in our human condition. And it's called being a tattletale. These people, and people in general, love to the term bootlick, or to suck up to authorities. Again, children do this, and adults do it too. And what that stems from is a rejoicing in the demise of others. And really what it comes down to is pride. It's, I want to be seen as more superior than someone else. And so if I go and tell the authorities that this person is breaking the law, well, then all of a sudden I look better in the eyes of the authorities. So not only do you get to rejoice in the demise of your neighbor, but you also get to feel a little bit better about yourself. During the early months of COVID, in 2020, down in Linden, Washington, there was a park just across the street from our house. And everything was closing down. Nobody knew what was going on. There were bodies piling up. And so they began to close everything. Everything from restaurants to shopping malls to outdoor venues such as parks and playgrounds. And so there was a climbing wall there at the playground across the street from us in Linden, just a climbing wall for kids, and there was, you know, some yellow tape around the playground. And there was a lone boy. You know, you look out in this giant field, this giant playground, there's a lone boy by himself, parents weren't there, climbing on the climbing wall. And I'm not condoning breaking into a playground when it's closed. Okay, that's not the point of the illustration. But there was a woman, an adult woman, walking by and saw this boy on the climbing wall. And so what did she do? She called 911. She called 911 and she's on the phone. What is your emergency? There's a boy on the playground, on the climbing wall, all by his lonesome. It's the human condition. But, you know, you can take it a little bit farther than that. In Russia in the 1970s and the 1980s, when Christianity, evangelism, the name of Christ was not allowed to be spoken, the true gospel was not allowed to be preached, churches in Russia went underground. And they would meet with all the doors and windows closed. They would sing quietly, whether it was the cold of winter or the heat of the day, without air conditioning. And in many of those churches, you had what were called informants, people that would purposefully come into those churches to try to ascertain if they were meeting underground and preaching and teaching in the name of Jesus. And then they would go and tell the Secret Service of that day, the KGB, that these churches were meeting. And I spoke with one Russian man when I was in Wisconsin, who actually was a child, a teenager, when all of that was going on, and he said that as a kid he didn't really realize what was happening when the KGB had surrounded a house as there was a church service going on. As kids, they thought it was kind of neat to look out and see the KGB, but then they would come in, they would arrest pastors, they would put them in prison for speaking the truth of God's word. But why in the world would people want to turn those pastors in? Why would neighbors, as they saw these people walking to these homes and joining in these church services, want to turn these people in? Because of the human condition of rejoicing in the demise of others and of the pride of the human heart as wanting to be seen as superior to someone else by the authorities. And that's exactly why these people turn on Jesus. In fact, it's why these people turn on Jesus all the time. Give us Barabbas. Because we want to go along with the crowd. We want to be thought of as superior. It's exactly why Peter denied Jesus three times. Even Peter not standing up for his Lord. The pride of the human heart. Well, we read here in verse 14 that it was the Sabbath day. Now, John makes a point of noting that Jesus made mud on the Sabbath. And you say, well, why would that matter that Jesus made mud? Well, remember, the Jews would add laws to the law. And one of the laws that they would add to the law was kneading. You were not allowed to knead on the Sabbath, which meant you couldn't do the action of making bread or making cakes. Well, Jesus had made mud. Now, interestingly enough, I had posed the question last time in last week's sermon, why did Jesus spit in the dirt and make mud? And we had an interesting conversation actually about that after the service that day, as that brings up several questions. And now I'm wondering if perhaps this is the answer he purposefully needed on the Sabbath. He did it on purpose, just the same as in John 5 when he healed the lame man on the Sabbath, knowing that when he said, take up your bed and walk, the authorities would be upset. Jesus' goal was to lead to the point where he would declare himself to be the I Am, where he would make them angry enough that he is claiming to be the Lord of the Sabbath and that they are the ones misunderstanding the Sabbath, so that he could fulfill his goal to come and die for us. And so he was kneading here on the Sabbath. Well, the Pharisees in verses 13 through 15 here, verse 15 specifically, ask this man the same question that the Jews asked. And he tells them the same likely story. So unlikely that it's undeniable. But that isn't going to stop the Pharisees from denying it as well. Verse 16. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. Folks, realization set in. Now, they tried to deny that he was from God. The same thing as John 7:29, because of the Sabbath. But really, they're just grasping at straws here. It's such an undeniable miracle. And now enter the determined denial of the depraved. The determined denial of the depraved. Here in verse 16, this is a key phrase in our text this morning. How can a man who is a sinner do such signs? In fact, we won't get there this morning, but Lord willing, if the Lord tarries in next week's sermon, we'll get to verse 33, and that's where the unblind man himself actually asks that very same question. How can a man who is a sinner do such signs? It's a rhetorical question, and that's the point. Jesus has to be from God. I told you at the beginning of the sermon that we wanted to ask the question, what do we learn about Christ this morning? He has to be from God. It is the dumbfounding undeniability of the divine. Now, who in the world in this group of Pharisees in verse 16 is sticking up for Jesus? Others. That's plural. So some of the Pharisees are saying, no, healing on the Sabbath can't be from God. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? So there's more than one person in the group of Pharisees claiming that Jesus is from God. Well, who would that be? Well, do you remember in John chapter 7 when they tried to arrest Jesus, that is the Pharisees, and one of the Pharisees stood up and said, oh, wait, we can't arrest this man until he's been given a fair trial. You remember who that was? That was our friend Nighttime Nicodemus. Nighttime Nicodemus stood up for Jesus in John chapter 7. But there was another man who was in amongst the Pharisees. The Bible calls him a secret disciple of Jesus, and that was Joseph of Arimathea. Joseph of Arimathea actually kept his little secret all the way past Jesus' crucifixion until such time as he secretly went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus so he could bury him in a rich man's tomb and thus fulfill an Old Testament prophecy. So likely the two people here that were standing up for Jesus were Nighttime Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. But if you'll remember something, back in John chapter 3, when Nighttime Nicodemus came to Jesus under cover of darkness, he said this to him in verse 2 of John chapter 3. We know that you are a teacher come from God. For no one can do these signs that you do unless he is from God. Now, this is what I would say about John 3:2. If we were living in the age of technology, that would be a tweet. And it would be framed, and it would become a meme, and there would be a little bit of text across it, and it would say this, that aged well. That aged well. Now, listen to it again. John 3, verse 2, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. Now look back at verse 16 and see what they said. How can a man who is a sinner do such signs? That sounds a lot like what Nicodemus said in John 3, 2. That aged well. Now there was a division among them, a division between the undeniability of the divine and the determined denial of the depraved. And as we said, this is the most concerted, organized, investigative review of a presumed fakery. And now we want to call our next witness, verse 17. So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? He said, he is a prophet. He is a prophet. Now, why are the Pharisees asking the blind man who he thinks Jesus is? Well, remember, and we're going to get to it, the Jews have made a rule about Jesus. And maybe they're assuming that this man is going to be too afraid, too scared to declare that this man is from God. If they can get the blind man himself to give glory to Yahweh and not to Jesus of Nazareth, then all of a sudden, Jesus of Nazareth hasn't done anything at all for the blind man. That's why they ask him. You can even hear it in their tone of voice. And what do you say about him since he healed you? In other words, you better not say he's from God. But this man does. He's a prophet. Now, I'm not going to say at this point that this man has believed, because the text doesn't say it. And in fact, the text is going to reveal later, 2 weeks from now, that he does accept Christ. But for now, we'll leave him in his unbelief. We'll leave him exactly where the woman at the well was. If you'll remember in John 4:19, the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." That was right before the woman at the well's conversion. She also declared the same thing that this unblind man did. You also remember in John chapter 6, after the feeding of the 5,000, when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." But what has the man declared? That Jesus is from God. He hasn't gotten his identity right yet, but he's declared that Jesus is from God. Well, now that the man himself has declared it, will the Pharisees believe? No. The determined denial of the depraved calls for their next witness, please. Verse 18. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he's of age. He will speak for himself." Now, what are the Pharisees hoping for by going to the parents? They're hoping for a contradictory answer. Whether they say, "This isn't our son, excommunicate him," or whether they say, "No, it wasn't of the power of Jesus, it was of the power of Yahweh." They don't care what the parents say. Make up a story if you want. They just want the parents to contradict that Jesus of Nazareth is a prophet, is from God. But instead, what do we have? Oh, we have our third verification. The man's identity is finally confirmed. The man's identity is finally confirmed. Now, the how is a bit of a mystery here. Isn't their answer kind of odd, kind of suspicious? They really don't know how his eyes were opened? Like he hadn't told them yet? Like his parents were not the first ones that he ran home and told? "The man named Jesus, he made mud and he anointed my eyes and he told me to go to Siloam and wash." You have to believe that they already had heard that story. You know, it seems like these parents are not sticking up for their son. It seems like these parents are kind of throwing their son under the bus, letting him take the heat. We don't know. We don't want to go there. Yep, it's our son. That's all we're going to say. You go talk to him about how it happened. And this is why I told you that right at the end of our passage, after we've seen the dumbfounding undeniability of the divine and the determined denial of the braved, now enter the chokehold of cowardice, the chokehold of cowardice. Verse 22. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." Gripping fear of falling out of favor. You know, it was common to fear the religious establishment of that day. In John 7:13, you remember when Jesus was supposed to come to the Feast of Booths? There was this secret murder plot, and Jesus' brothers asked him to come, and he said, "No, I'm not coming." So the brothers went anyway. Jesus doesn't show up at the Feast of Booths with his brothers, and everyone's chattering in private. Where is Jesus? But John 7:13 says, "Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him." The Jews had massive power in that day. Even Joseph of Arimathea secretly took the body. In John 19:38, "Nevertheless, many even of the authorities believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue." That's what we see here in verse 22. What were the parents so afraid of? They were afraid of being put out of the synagogue. You say, "Well, what does that mean? Can't go to church?" There were three different levels that we see about 100 years after this event. So we don't know exactly what was meant by being put out of the synagogue at this particular event. But there is oral tradition that's been passed down about 100 years out from this event of what it means to be put out of the synagogue. And so in reviewing that, it might give us a little bit of idea of what they were afraid of. Well, the first level of being put out of the synagogue was you were not allowed in the synagogue for 30 days. You had to remain 6 feet away from every other Jew. You couldn't shave, and you couldn't enter the temple through the normal gate. Now, that level there, that was the first social distancing. And so, you know, Canada was 2 meters, in the United States it was 6 feet, and in Israel it was 4 cubits. The second level of being put out of the synagogue was to be formally cursed. You couldn't interact with anyone. You couldn't enter the temple or the synagogue. But the third level of being put out of the synagogue was this: to be cut off from the people. To be cut off entirely from the people of Israel. As one commentator said, to be consigned to utter perdition. That's what they were afraid of. That's why the parents didn't want to say a word about how their son was healed. Ask him, gripped by the chokehold of cowardice. Now, I have a question for any of you who have never confessed Jesus, who have never accepted Jesus as your Savior. What's stopping you? The fear of man, the chokehold of cowardice, or are you the depraved that is just determined to deny him? You know, Romans 10, 9, and 10 says that if you will confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Well, what were these parents too afraid to do? To confess Jesus as Lord because of the chokehold of cowardice. And so I ask, are you? Matthew 10, 32 through 33 says, "So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I also will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven." That's a scary thought. I hope that if you are here today or listening today and you have not confessed Jesus as Lord, believed in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, for the salvation of your soul, that you would do that today. But those of you who say, "I've done that, I've confessed him as Lord," well, then I say this to the Christians. Are you a victim of the chokehold of cowardice? Are you a victim of the chokehold of cowardice? Are you afraid to witness, to tell people about what being a Christian is, or even to let people know that you are a Christian? Are you afraid to keep your mouth clean or turn away from sinful activities so that people will know I'm a Christian? They'll think less of me. Are you willing to be seen as weird? To kind of be brushed to the side? Are you afraid of what the world thinks? Are you afraid to be put out of the synagogue? Matthew 10, 26 says this, "So have no fear of them, for nothing is covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light. And what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not 2 sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore. You are of more value than many sparrows." Are you a secret disciple of Jesus? Oh, I have news for you. Your biggest fears will come true. You'll be put out of the synagogue. You will. John 16:2, Jesus said, they will put you out of the synagogues. Indeed, the hour is coming when whoever kills you will think he is offering service to God. But brothers and sisters, we are blessed when that happens. Luke 6:22, blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day. Leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for so their fathers did to the prophets. You are blessed. Peter wrote about it in 1 Peter 3:14, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. And so I asked this morning, do you really believe that you're blessed when you're put out of the synagogue? Or is that what you are trying to avoid? Are you willing to be put out of the synagogue? The unblind man was. We'll see that in the coming weeks. Now, you say, well, we can't really be put out of the synagogue today. We don't live in Israel. No, but there's things that can happen to us. You know, we could lose a friend. I have, just by sharing the gospel. Maybe you could lose a job, or at least not be thought of real well on the job anymore. You could lose a family member over the gospel, over Christ. Oh, you could be viewed differently. Oh, somebody could be upset at you. They could be really upset at you. For 30 years, they could be upset at you. Or maybe you have to upset someone. Whew. Make someone feel a little uncomfortable, or the worst of worst, be known as judgy. Ooh. Folks, those parents might have had a lot to lose. We don't know what their jobs were. We don't know what their positions were. But I'll tell you something, the more we have to lose, the more we don't want to lose. The more we have to lose, the more we don't want to lose. Oh, we're going to see next week that this unblind man who sat as a beggar all these years had nothing to lose. And we'll see how he reacted when he was asked the same questions as his parents. So I leave you with this. What do we learn about Christ today? Well, his miracles prove that he's from God. It's undeniable. What do we learn about us today? That even though we know that Christ is God, we're controlled by the chokehold of cowardice. And so would you proclaim Christ? Would you confess him? Friends, Jesus confesses you before his Father in heaven. Let's pray. Our God, we are so controlled by what man thinks of us. We so long for comfort and ease. We so despise confrontation and division that we will do anything to keep from it. We'll do anything to keep our comfortable jobs and our comfortable cars and our comfortable shopping and our comfortable houses. Anything, even if it means that we don't confess you before men. Oh God, would you keep us from the chokehold of cowardice? And as you have allowed us to be dumbfounded by the undeniability of the divinity of Jesus Christ, would we go into a world that is determined to deny you because of their depravity? Would we boldly profess the name of Christ, knowing that we are already and will be forever blessed? We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.